We'll get
cracking. Guys, what is the crack? Welcome to the Bitcoin with Dini podcast. I want to welcome Angelo Morgan Summers. Angelo, you're welcome.
Thanks for having me, mate.
Yeah, you're doing awesome work there with Fast Bitcoins, and you're throwing out some amazing content. So I was really keen to try and get you on. So thanks for agreeing to come on today and chat to us. But let's start off just with an introduction to Angelo. Tell us about yourself, man.
Right. Do you want the backstory, the villain origin story, or just what I'm up to at the moment?
Oh, give us the villain story.
Right, cool. So, basically, I grew up where I am right now, which is in Southwest Wales. I went to a very Christian / authoritarian primary school. So that was my introduction to authority. And it didn't go very well. I was labeled by the teachers as disruptive but not naughty, which for like a six-year-old was very confusing, because I thought the disruptive kids were the naughty ones and the naughty ones were the disruptive ones. But apparently I was disruptive without being naughty, which is just confusing. Basically, I think that was their kind way of saying that they didn't like me and I was annoying. So it wasn't a great fit. And then going into secondary school, I think I had to, well, through primary school as well, I would always find little obsessions to get involved in, and whether it be an idea, or a lot of the time at that age it was to do with physical things like sports and different stuff like that. So I think for a while I was really into magic, like doing magic tricks and stuff, but I could never practice them for long enough before I showed them to people, so it'd always fail. Then I was into unicycling, so I used to unicycle to my primary school and stuff, just to have a bit of excitement at the beginning and the end of each day. And basically I would just cycle through these interests until secondary school, which is when I found parkour, which is basically, if you've seen the videos of people jumping across rooftops and stuff like that, little 10-year-old Angelo saw that and thought it was awesome as hell, because Spider-Man was his favorite superhero, so he wanted to be like that, and started practicing it basically. And funnily enough, in the secondary school that I went to, they just started offering parkour classes after school from a local lad that had started this company trying to teach it. So I got quite into that quite quickly, and got pretty good at it as well. It was like sort of my main thing then. It was all I was thinking about and all I was spending my time on outside of going to school and stuff. And unfortunately, I'd say the problems that faced me with primary school with respect to the structure of the authority continued on through into secondary school. I was never very great at recognizing authority, I don't think. I could recognize it, but it just the lack of nuance in the structure of teaching and stuff didn't really suit me very well, because well, whether it's nature or nurture, I don't know, but it just didn't suit me very well. And so that just brought more of my attention over to parkour, and I started doing competitions and stuff. And this is when I was like 12, so I wasn't crazy good or anything, but good enough to go to the competitions, and that brought me a lot of happiness and excitement outside of school life. And then I went to this one competition when I was 12, in Bridgend, I believe. And while I was doing one of my practice routes, I had this jump from a brown little like crate to a scaffolding bar, and then another scaffolding bar like 8 foot across from that, and they were about 6 foot high or something, and misjudged the landing onto the second bar. My left foot was slightly behind my right foot, which caused me to slip, essentially take none of the impact through my legs, and instead take all of the impact through the side of my rib cage, which is not where you want to be taking the impact from the jump.
not much there.
There's really not much there to protect. I mean, it's like a thin layer of skin and then just bone and internal organs. One of the internal organs that happens to be on the side of myself that I landed was the spleen, which is a big sack of blood that filters 80% of your body's blood flow every 2 hours, which means that if that sack of blood bursts, you have about 2 hours before 80% of your blood has gone through a hole inside of you, which is a very bad situation. Funnily enough, the same thing happened to my dad when he was 8 years old. He got hit by a car and burst it, and so had to have it removed. Luckily, he lived in closer range to a hospital, so he was actually able to be fine. But if you don't live close to a hospital, then that's a bad situation. So yeah, after that accident, ended up going home, and after a few days, I was like, it's not any better, it's getting worse, it feels really bad, we should probably go to the doctor. And I was Googling the symptoms, like, why do I feel like this, and why is my, it's like a dull pain, but it comes and it goes, and all of this, and the internet was telling me all the ways in which I was going to die, which was fun. But then I went to the hospital, and they said it might be an issue with your spleen, and sort of said that if you like trip or fall over, then what could be happening is that in the lining of your spleen there could be a tear, like halfway, which is quite common. So it's not fully burst, but you know, when you tear a sheet of paper halfway, it becomes very easy to get the final amount there. So if I was
Sure.
to fall over or fall down the stairs, or even they said if I turn awkwardly in my sleep, it could rip it open and burst. So I was like, okay. I thought 12, you're supposed to still be alive. So that sort of brought into it brought directly in front of my face for the first time in my life the scarcity of time. And I knew, obviously, you learn about your own mortality before the age of 12. You realize that sometime before you're 10. But it's a distant concept, and it's something that you think that only the adults have to deal with. And so when it's brought close to your face, and it's like, oh, this might be your time to deal with this part of life now, you go, oh, okay. So yeah, it really could just go at any moment. And mortality becomes, it shifts from something that is a potential occurrence at some point later down the line, or for some future version of yourself, and it becomes a state that you're currently in. And you realize that's not just true now with this injury, but that was always true my whole life, and it always will be true. We are in a state of mortality, which means at any point it could be over. And without getting too deep or crazy or anything, that's basically what led me to leave school, because school wasn't a good suit to me, and I felt like it was like an inefficient use of my time, basically, because the class is always tended to the teaching is always has to be paced to the slowest in the class, and it was not the greatest school or anything either. So a lot of time, I think, was wasted, and time became the most valuable resource then. And so I decided to write this 22-page document to my family, basically outlining the pros and cons of home education. And I think my goal with that was to basically learn everything I was learning at school, but just do it in my own time and just blast through it as fast as possible, so that I could continue on learning about things that interested me. But unfortunately, it didn't go exactly to plan. I ended up leaving school, but when I would try to study the stuff that they taught at schools, it felt directionless, because it is. The curriculum that they teach you at the age of 12 is purposefully directionless, because 12-year-olds don't have much direction. And so you sort of need to give them a bit of maths and a bit of English and a bit of geography, and teach them about shapes and a bit of algebra here, and see what sticks. But it didn't suit me, because I was like, okay, now that I've actually got some time, I can sort of figure out what I'm interested in and figure out what matters to me, and then try and learn about that. And so I think the first year then of being in home education, was a matter of figuring out what my goals were. And I came to the conclusion that I wanted to achieve freedom in time, location, and money. And with those three things, then I would be free to be interested in magic and unicycling and parkour and all of that stuff as much as I wanted. And so about a year after that, I found out about Ethereum on the footnote of this Goldbug article that my dad was subscribed to, like a newsletter thing. And he had asked me to take a look at it, because it was something to learn about, and he didn't understand it, and he wanted to know what the guy was on about. So I started learning about that a little bit. This was when I was 13 now. And yeah, I realized it's pretty complicated, and everything pointed to Bitcoin. Because to understand what the hell the blockchain was, all of the learning materials were about Bitcoin's blockchain, especially at that time. And the crypto marketing behemoth hadn't really taken over the space yet. So I started looking into Bitcoin then. And you know, when you start le learning about Bitcoin, you can hear in the tone of the voices of the people who speak about it, there's something a bit different. It's not just people talking about MasterCard or Visa and explaining how it works, I could hear in their tone something that sort of sparked my intrigue, which is this sort of, it was like they were, it was like the tone of people who had just discovered like a massive gold mine and were very excited about it. And I think that rubbed off on me, and I got excited about it and didn't understand any of it for a while. But after sort of jamming my head against the books a little bit, I ended up sort of getting a grasp of at least what Bitcoin was trying to achieve. And then, yeah, then that penny drop moment happened. For me, it was when I learned about the nonce in, and how the nonce is the sort of like, or like the target for block difficulty. And that was like the final piece of the puzzle to me of how it works. And then once I got how it works, I got what it was for. And then when I got what it was for, I'd already done some learning about like the traditional finance systems and how the world currently works in terms of the distribution of resources. And so I was sort of mind blown at that point and hooked. And it's sort of been my main interest ever since that moment. And so, yeah, that's sort of how, that's the villain origin story of how I got into Bitcoin. And yeah, so I'm still into it now at 20.
Awesome. I have a unicycle down in the shed there. I take it out on Patrick's Day, where I dress up as a leprechaun and cycle through the parade promoting whatever business I happen to be promoting. So they're an awesome tool. They're fun, and they're not that hard as well, I don't think. You know, as hard as you think. I don't know.
No.
Deadly. So I just wanted to ask you this just for a bit of crack. It's 2043. You are in your 40s. You're my age. What is the price or the value of Bitcoin in a perfect world if this whole thing works out well and adoption continues? How does the world look? What's the value of it? What's changed? I'll give you a cap of maximum 10 minutes.
Yeah.
In case you go off for 3 hours on this, which you well could.
I don't know. I'd say there's two answers. You could say something like, oh, $1 million a coin and get everyone excited, and that would be cool. Or you could have the answer of 200 million, because not of the increase in value of Bitcoin, but the devaluation of that which is measured against. And that could be an ideal world for Bitcoiners, but it might not be an ideal world in general, because if the currency devalues that much, it's going to have some effects beyond just the finance space. You'll see it on the streets. And so I don't want it to all collapse, but it's looking like it is collapsing. And for that reason, I think it's sort of an ideal world, maybe isn't the best way of phrasing it, because I don't think it's a good thing in general. That everything's sort of falling apart in the way that it is, but I guess it's just the situation we've got to acknowledge. And so
but can Bitcoin save it? Like, this is the perfect world. In the next 20 years, do people adopt it? Do enough people adopt this thing over 2 decades that,
well, yeah, the worst case scenario is everything falls to pieces and nobody goes to Bitcoin for help, right? That's the worst case. But assuming that if it does fall, everyone goes to Bitcoin, then yeah, let's just say 1 million, because it's fun.
Yeah. Give us your 3 minute explanation of Bitcoin. You know, when you meet someone on the street, or they hop out of a taxi, or someone says, what do you do? And you say, I'm into Bitcoin. They're like, what the hell is that? You know, and you've only got like 3 minutes. How do you try and pitch it to somebody to leave them with some sort of value and some sort of a carrot to continue their education?
Okay, so this is a glass of water. The circle on the top of it isn't a perfect circle. Plato, that guy in one of those books there, had an idea that the real world of things is in he had this philosophy of forms, which is that there are perfect circles in the ideal realm. They'll never be found in actual reality. You can only describe them with maths. I think the same thing applies with money. Money is a form in the Platonic sense. And so, as you've seen across history, there's been many different forms of money, and many different items have filled that role. Bitcoin is the latest addition to that, and it checks more boxes than any of the rest of them.
Sweet. I just leave that conversation going. There's a nutter.
Yeah. That's fair.
You're on the fitness buzz, which I like to see. I think every human is better when they look after themselves physically. You just become a better version of yourself. My journey was from broken back, and that taught me everything about become wealthy, I learned by becoming healthy. It was all the fundamentals, all the principles. It's just so relatable. And I think it also ties into Bitcoin, like proof of work, deferred gratification, having low time preference, ability to endure pain, maybe a little bit as well, personal accountability and responsibility, and sometimes leveraging communities and stuff. Have you noticed changes in yourself since? Well, I suppose you're always fit, but you seem to be hitting the gym now and putting on a bit of muscle, because I've seen a before and after picture of you over the last couple of years. Like, and you're making some gains, man, and you don't make gains without putting in the work. But do you see the similarities between Bitcoin and physical fitness, or?
Yeah, I think the most obvious connection to draw is the proof of work thing, right? It's like you have to actually expend the energy to get the results, and nothing comes for free. I think the one of the core principles that flows through the design and the philosophy of Bitcoin is that there ain't no such thing as a free lunch, and fitness is the first thing I think that'll teach you that, is that there really ain't no such thing as a free lunch. If you want the abs, there's no 5 minute abs. And yeah, I think I've been into fitness since I was younger, but it's always been something that I think has helped to keep me sane as well. If I don't do any physical activity for a long period of time, I start going a little bit loopy. And so yeah, it's definitely something that, and I think that applies for pretty much everybody as well, even if they don't realize it because they've never done much physical activity. I think if you start doing it, you'll realize how much it actually grounds you.
We look for, like, I worked in the fitness industry. I still work in the fitness industry. I'm 2 decades running businesses in it, or owning businesses in it, I suppose, at this stage. But we all look for the free and the easy. It's like, it's so hard to sell them what works. They just want to buy the pill or buy the quick way or the easy way. And people just don't want to do the work. One thing I noticed, and this is just a side note, maybe I'm just old and cynical now, but no, I'm definitely not. There's no, I wasn't like this when I was in my 20s, but I was in the gym there during the week and I looked around and 50%, I kid you not, over 50% of the people there were on phones. They were just sitting on the machines on the phones. And there's a trend with young people now and they're in the gym, which is great, but man, they can't work. Like, I'm one of the oldest in the place and I'm the most sweatiest, the reddest looking, and panting and grunting, lifting. Like, I'm putting in the work. And I'm like, man, you can get away with that in your 20s, but when you get to your 30s and 40s, you actually have to do some work. When you're in your 20s, you have so much hormones, you have so much of your human growth hormone, testosterone. All you have to do is look at the weight. You can eat like crap and you don't really have to train that hard and you get great results, but that's not going to cut it once you start getting close to your 30s and into your 40s and 50s. So I don't know, like, would you agree with the statement that the work ethic seems to be going down and people aren't able to put themselves in as much pain, or is that just me being old and cynical?
I think yeah, there's a with the accessibility of like dopamine these days, it's easy to have an easy way out, and so people are, I think their attention spans have dropped for sure, and I think that's sort of like one of the backbones of work ethic is attention span, right? If you can't pay attention to the thing you're working on for longer than 5 minutes, then you're not going to get much work done. So yeah, I do think it's dropping off. Do you do cardio, or is it like are you doing weights or both?
I do everything, man. I have a million different hobbies, sports. I've done triathlons, Ironmans. I've done Ireland's longest swim. I've done,
I was looking at Ironman
calisthenics,
the other day.
gymnastics, yeah, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I was looking at Ironman the other day. They do one locally here that I wanted to sign up for. Not that I could do it right now, but I wanted to like, do the thing where you sign up for something that you can't do and then get to the point where you can do it in time. But yeah, it just looks like hell. I don't know if I could ever do an Ironman.
I'll be honest with you, I've done a lot of endurance stuff and maybe I have too much self-belief, but I think I could do, there's no endurance thing that I couldn't do because it's just mindset, it's just pain and being good at endurance. Yeah, your cardiovascular system improves, but it's just that your ability to suffer improves. And that's why I like long distance endurance stuff, because it really builds your mental strength and your ability to put yourself through absolute pain. And I think that's important. And maybe that's what's wrong with a lot of people in the gym, that they just don't want the pain. As soon as the reps get hard, they stop. Whereas, people who get results, it's like that's, you have to wait till it gets hard and sore before you're actually doing anything. All the ones before that are just getting you to this point. This is where the work begins, not where it ends.
I think it was Arnold that said, was it Arnold or one of the bodybuilder guys said, I only start counting when it starts hurting because that's the only point where it matters.
That was Arnold, I think. Yeah, deadly. Yeah, and we had an interesting thing there yesterday in Ireland where the Bank of Ireland ATMs had a glitch And people could go, if you had no money in your bank, you could go to the ATM. And I was giving people, I think it was up to 1,000 quid, and or I also heard it was 1,500 quid. So there was queues outside ATMs in Ireland last night, and people had a savage night, and they all got free money. But like, it's not free money. There's going to be a consequence to taking that money out of that bank machine. There's no such thing as free. Free, if you don't know where the cost is in free, you're the cost. It's costing you. And we don't realize that, I don't think.
No, there's a lot of fundamental principles like that, as well as there ain't no such thing as a free lunch, that I think people they just overlook or forget, willfully ignore.
It's about Bitcoin, not blockchain or crypto, according to Angelo Morgan Summers. Can you take us through that and tell us why you came to that conclusion and help us understand?
So yeah, I had my crypto moment, as a lot of people do when they get into the space. I think there's something so enticing, especially when you're first looking at it from a how can I make more money perspective, and you're looking at Bitcoin, and you have the cognitive framing bias of Bitcoin is the numerical value on the price of a single Bitcoin is higher than that of its alternative coins, and you see that, oh, it must be easier, or there must be more upside than if the other ones are down here and they're newer. I think there's something really enticing about the idea that it's like Facebook versus MySpace occurring in the cryptocurrency realm. And I think that's probably the best marketing tagline for crypto ever, is like comparing it to like the internet versus landline phones or whatever it is, because everybody thinks, oh yeah, Bitcoin, well, I can only send transactions. And then Ethereum, I can buy pictures and all of this stuff, even though you can do that with Bitcoin now as well, but it's not really marketed because Bitcoin doesn't have a marketing department. So yeah, I think that eventually I realized that I think a lot of it came from looking under the hood of Bitcoin and understanding more about how the thing actually functions and what solutions in terms of the software solutions were put in place in order to fix the challenges of creating digital money that works. And as I got more familiar with that and with the design, I realized how nuanced it was, and I realized how everything was incredibly purposeful and worked in relation to everything else, including the existence of the blockchain and the consensus mechanism at large. And so then you start to realize, hang on a second, if this is a purpose-built, it's like a laser, like a dagger, it's direct to the point of what exactly it's trying to do. And then you see these other coins that are trying to be like, oh yeah, we're blockchain as well. You know, that thing that's used to create the one form of digital money that works. But are you digital money? No, we're file sharing. And it's like, huh, okay, why blockchain then? And then you start to ask that question. And I think at the beginning it's hard to separate blockchain from Bitcoin and from the consensus mechanism. And it's hard to compartmentalize the different concepts. But once you do, you can start to ask the question, okay, why blockchain? And you ask that across all of these different alternative coin projects, and all too often the only viable answer that was coming to my head was great marketing. And it just gives these people a lot of attention that they would have otherwise had to spend money on acquiring if they had done it the centralized route. And so I think the buzziness of it all brought a hell of a lot of attention from a lot of swindlers and opportunistic marketers that take advantage of the fertile soil of blockchain and the buzzwords surrounding it. But yeah, it took a while to figure that out. But I think the best thing I've likened it to is it is like attaching, like if you imagine a world where they first invented the car and the car engine, or car wheels, for instance. Car wheels are then heralded as like the thing that are getting you from A to from London to Wales in like a couple hours, the quickest thing in the world, and so they must be super revolutionary. And then marketers go and take car wheels and put them on skateboards, and it's like marketing them as revolutionary because they're using the car wheel or they're using the blockchain in their thing. But it's like, why? It's a skateboard, it doesn't need that. And so yeah.
So, do you think that everything happening outside of Bitcoin is just a waste of time and a scam? Because there's so much energy gone into it, there's so much money gone into it, there's so much human capital alone, and like, you know, we can say, ah, they're scammers, but like, they're not all scammers. Some people genuinely think they're a force for good and they're solving a real world problem. Where do you sit on that? Like,
so I'm uncomfortable calling pretty much anything a waste of time, because I think that sort of posits you as having some omnipotent overview of everything that's happening, and you can see all the puzzle pieces and you know exactly what's good for the world and exactly what's bad for it. And I think that's kind of an arrogant statement to make. So I wouldn't say that it's all a waste of time. I think there has obviously been time wasted, especially on the side of the clear scams that are run by people who genuinely don't have any interest in the project. They're just trying to look for a quick buck. That's obviously wasteful. But I think other things, even Ethereum, as much as I dislike the project, I think that to call it a waste of time is silly, because some mistakes have to be made. And yeah, I think it's almost, you're asking too much of the world if you're asking it to sort of grace this new form of money and all of the revolutionary ideas and revolutionary potential futures that it could afford us, and expect the people not to go and experiment with it, since it's open source and you can copy and paste the code and change a few parameters and call it their own. I think people are going to do that, and it's just a matter of letting the cards play out on the board, letting the pieces play out on the board and seeing how it goes. So yeah, I wouldn't say it's definitely not all a scam, because I know for a fact when I was really into the crypto stuff, I genuinely believed it as well. And I would think that if I was to be hired by one of those cryptocurrency companies, then I would genuinely believe that I was doing good work. And so I think that's probably the vast majority of people who are involved in it, at least in the bigger projects. But yeah, in all of the projects at the fringes, the dog coins, well, maybe not literally Dogecoin, but yeah, all of the Shiba Inu and Rocket Moon coin and all of this stuff is just, yeah, that, I'd say that's a lot of that time and energy is wasted in the end.
Do you see us having another bull run, sort of catalyst from the halving, 2024-ish?
Yeah.
Do you see crypto doing what it's done on all the previous bull runs?
Yeah.
And all the
I think it's a cycle that will continue and just lose steam with each one, because every time it happens and there's a big bull run, all the swindlers come, they build the FTXs, they build the this and the that, and then it all crashes down, and then it leaves a burn on the minds of everybody that was involved. And so I think there's, when you're repeating the same scam over and over again, eventually it'll run out of steam.
But each time there's new participants who have to make the mistake, so they don't have the experience that the last cohort have. So and as each cycle increases in the amount of adopters it sucks in, you know, I think along your lines, but I also think I'm thinking the opposite. I'm like, well, there's going to be a new cohort of people every cycle, there's a bigger cohort coming, so they're going to likely repeat all the same mistakes that I made when I first came to crypto and then Bitcoin. And then my thinking along that lines is, well, just as a means of generating capital for myself, my family, me being a hedge fund, should I use my knowledge to profit from the mistakes of others? Should I invest in crypto? Where would you sit on that? And I'll tell you how I deal with my clients, because I'm interested to hear your take on that. Like, do you invest in crypto, or are you just like, no, I'm not interested, don't touch it?
So personally for me, no, I don't. But I think if other people do, I'm not going to tell them that they're the devil incarnate. I think people can get quite rowdy and emotional about this stuff. But yeah, I think there's a big difference between buying something that you know is going to go up in value because it's done it every single time, and just taking the profit from that. There's a difference between that and pushing a bunch of marketing material, setting up your own scam, and then actually trying to harvest the millions from loads of people who are less wealthy than you. There's a big difference between those two, obviously, so they have to be treated differently. And I think the big problem that a lot of avid Bitcoiners make is that they treat it all the same, and they end up alienating a whole big portion of the movement, which is everybody that's interested in crypto and Bitcoin. And they basically say, no, you're not friends with us, you can't sit with us. And they tell everybody that's invested in crypto that they're evil. And then the crypto people get separated from Bitcoin even more so because of that. So I think there has to be some level of understanding there, and to not hold people to unreconcilable standards as well.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, like, because they probably have euros in their bank accounts, you know, dirty fiat. You know, it's like, you're a hypocrite. Yeah, and how I would deal with it with my clients, because they would ask that question, like, should I, you know, part of what I do is consulting about building what we call a Plan B pension, and it's based around Bitcoin. And the reason for that is Bitcoin sort of fulfills the needs of a pension. It's something that I think you can hold for a long period of time, and it doesn't have risk, whereas everything in crypto doesn't sort of fulfill that. It's high risk stuff. So I'm like, if I'm building a pension, I'm not going to build it on startup companies. That's just doesn't make sense. I'm building on digital scarcity all day long, like, because isn't that what pensions are searching for? They're just trying to protect capital, and you protect capital by having it in something that's really, really scarce. So that's how I sort of quantify it, that if it's a pension strategy, Bitcoin really makes a lot of sense. And if it's just a speculative gambling, get rich quick strategy, which is like rare, very rarely works, well, then perhaps crypto, because, you know, some people it will work for, but the majority it won't work for. Just like one person wins the lotto and millions don't, but one person does win, and that's the person who gets marketed, and their lifestyle gets marketed, and that's why we buy the tickets, because we hope that that person's us. Deadly. Chat a little bit about the adoption then of Bitcoin. Like, how do you feel the adoption is going? Like, are we on track? Are we behind? Are we being slowed? What are some of the headwinds? What are the tailwinds? You know, how do you see, because ultimately Bitcoin's success comes from more people using it, more monetary energy going into it, more people understanding it. You know, you've been in the space since, I suppose, 2013, when you first came across crypto. You know, what have you seen over the years, and are you happy with where we are today in 2023?
I think every Bitcoiner wants it to be further along, because it's just sort of saddening sometimes to see the level of apathy within pop culture, because it's not like nobody knows about Bitcoin. It's quite well known about now. But again, it's just like in the same way that you might have heard about it before you got into it, where it's just like briefly mentioned as some form of internet money, and that's that. I think the adoption is definitely, it's directionally correct. I wish the speed was quicker, but that's just the nature of the game. I mean, we've had the fiat money for hundreds of years now, and it's not going to be an overnight change to Bitcoin, especially considering that it's not just like the change from gold to fiat, which itself took a while, but was essentially just the process of issuing paper claims on the gold and then using those paper claims to trade. So it wasn't even a full transition, but now we're asking for a full transition, which is we're not offering claims on fiat with some internet thing, in the way that you would use a digital banking app, where you've got these ones and zeros that represent claims on fiat. We're asking for an actual full transference from paper and government issued currency to a currency that isn't issued by a government. And I think that is the key point that makes the adoption such a challenging, or will make it such a slow process, is because there's a lot more hurdles and a lot more friction in moving the world from a money and state married zeitgeist to one of Bitcoin. And so I don't know whether or not that will be achieved through education and making people aware of why it's important, or if it'll be a fact of people get burnt and then they start looking. I think it's more likely to be the latter, because in general people have got busy lives and they're not gonna, I mean, just temperamentally, like the vast majority of people aren't sort of don't tend towards learning about various things in their free time, let alone money things and the finance system and stuff. So I don't think it'll really be education alone, but Yeah, as things get worse, people will start looking for, well, as the ship starts sinking, people start looking for lifeboats, right? And yeah, I think the ship is still staying afloat today. Things aren't great. Obviously, inflation's gone crazy and a lot of things are looking unstable, but the ship is still very much afloat. And so people can still sort of live the lie for now, but eventually the truth will always surface.
Yeah, the world's crazy, and one of my things is, Angelo, is like, I think education is going to be the biggest catalyst in Bitcoin's adoption, and it's like this: every cycle there's a new cohort of people, and their net worth increases after serving their 4-year apprenticeship. No guarantee that continues in the future, but that's just been the way it's been for now, and this cohort of people. Unlike if you're some other skill where you keep it a secret and you don't tell people what you're doing, because that's your edge. You want to do it. If you've got a product and you can sell it, you don't want anyone to realize what you're doing. But as a Bitcoiner, you're like, guys, I discovered this thing. It's amazing. It's made my life better. I think you should check it out and study it. In fact, if you want to sit down with me, I'll meet you anytime and I'll teach you about this thing. And you swan around, like I swan around my blue fancy car, and I think I'm great. And people go, what are you doing? It's like he's not a brain surgeon. He just bought some Bitcoin and he saves in Bitcoin. He uses it as a savings vehicle. And then it's like the next cycle. Okay, there's another car. Now this idiot has a nicer car than me and this idiot. And I'm still here going, nah, that thing's a scam. And this is like, how many cycles until eventually each cycle more people are going to get sucked in because humans have, can't remember who I was chatting to. Was it Greg Foss or Peter Dunworth? I can't remember. One of them was like, once humans just keep doing what we always do, which is just being fearful and greedy. And it's just our greed is going to be, well, it's you have to keep up with your neighbors, and if they're doing well, you're noticing, you're noticing. And if they're telling you what they're doing and they're saying, I will show you, it's like, well, okay, show me. And fast forward that over the next 2, 3 cycles, how much more of global population do we suck in over 2 or 3 cycles? Because it'll be like the next cycle will be the fourth halving. Fifth, sixth, it's like fool me once, fool me twice, but like fool me 6 times and I'm still ignoring this thing. It's like, come on, people. So I think the education is just going to continue to suck people in, and the proof of work on taking the time to be educated, because the proof of that work is that you don't have worries about your future, you don't have the same problems, inflation problems, cost of living problems that people who continue to ignore Bitcoin are suffering from. You see the solutions. You see Bitcoin helped me understand all the problems in the world. As I said, fitness and nutrition, that was my game. That was my entry into business. But I seen so much wrong. Nothing made sense in that world until I understood fiat. It was like, how are we pushing out a food pyramid and telling people to eat 9 portions of processed carbohydrates a day? How are we doing this? Like, how in this day and age of science and technology? And then studying Bitcoin, it was like, it just all started to click to me. And I was like, oh my God, misguided incentives, fiat. Yes, this makes total sense now. Yeah, it's going down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. Like it changes people. Not just that they think they're going to get rich. That's what I think a lot of people come for. And that's fine. That's a human's being fearful and greedy, fearful someone's going to get ahead of me and greedy that I want that. So that's what sucks us in, but then it totally changes you and it changes your time preference. And I've seen this that in our community, people are more conscious about their health. They're more conscious about their spending habits, that do they need the thing, the material thing now? It's like, no, well, I can actually put that into, I can save that money, and that money has the potential to grow into something much, much more. And therefore I can have a much better future as opposed to just getting my little gratification hit right now and purchasing whatever this material thing is. So just change it, and then you wind that out. Like, how does that change the world? That's why I ask you the question. In a perfect world in 2043, this is the perfect world where Bitcoin has worked. How has humanity changed? Like, are we totally different in how we interact with each other and how the whole world works? There's more cooperation, there's more love, there's less violence, there's less hate. There's more understanding of time preference. There's more understanding of health. There's more understanding of family and moments in actual real life rather than dopamine hits in the cyber world, which isn't reality. And I think that's my crazy philosophy. philosophy on like Bitcoin's going to change the world for the better. It's much more than just a financial asset. Like it's going to change how we interact with each other. Like.
I think definitely there's a sort of if you go back to caveman times, there was interpersonal like dynamics, and the way that we structured our societies was based, I think, in large part around the scarcity of resources. Pretty much all social checklists, in a sense, or social rule books that developed and became cultures came from the necessity to deal with the fact that there are scarce resources. And I think the way that we evolved as animals, not just humans, but all other species as well, we evolved according to this rule, which is that there are scarce resources. We need to acquire them so that we succeed. And we also need to provide enough of them to people who have similar genetic codes to us such that they can actually propagate, be that family members and stuff. And this sort of, I don't know if you've read The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins,
No.
great book, but it basically takes a bird's eye perspective at like what is the human. And rather than thinking that a human has genetics in the same way that like a tree produces seeds, it flips it on its head and says the genetics have humans. And in the same way that a seed could use a tree in order to produce more seeds, rather than a tree using a seed to produce more trees. And so when you flip it on its head, you see that there's all these rules, and the way that the tree grows is all in favor of the successful reproduction of the seed. And so everything about culture and about the development of the biological organisms that we are, it came about in a world where resources were scarce, and there were certain hard facts about reality that we had to constantly come into contact with. Every single day, when we were looking for food and didn't find it, when it was cold and we got tired, and when we got ill, there were these hard truths about reality that we came into contact with and couldn't ignore. We couldn't bullshit our way out of them, basically. And then with the addition of like fiat monetary systems, where governments and the issuers of the currency can essentially just print it at their own will, we sort of undo a lot of the design that, in a similar way that altcoins are sort of taking the design of Bitcoin and then trying to apply it for a different purpose, or undermining some of the nuanced design specificity that was present in Bitcoin in order to try and do backflips and somersaults and all of that. In the same way, the way that we structure our world in a fiat-based system where we can print as much as we want is doing the same thing. It's taking these very nuanced designs of humans and of animals and of culture and of intuition and reasoning and all of this, and it's shifting it, and it's sort of disrespecting the foundations upon which all of that was built, and saying, no, we're God now. We can just create resources out of thin air. And it's not true. You can't. There is no such thing as a free lunch. You can print as much money as you want. It's not going to make the world any wealthier. It's just going to redistribute that wealth. And so until we come back to a world where we can constantly have to operate against that paradigm, we're always going to be slightly insane, because we're always going to be able to convince ourselves of things that aren't quite true. And when I say we, I'm saying in large part the people that have control over the issuance of the currency and the people who get their hands on newly issued currency first. Because if you can just get a bunch of money for free and then go and build a bunch of things, you end up getting these sort of second, third order effects that are described in the fiat standard, where food becomes worse and lifestyle becomes unhealthier, and we just sort of degrade in a way, and devolve into crazy talking monkeys, really, that think that they can outwit the universe, but we can't. And so if we come back to a world in which the money, which is the way that we represent all of the value and the resources in the world, is scarce, just like the value and the resources are, then we come in closer contact with reality. And I think that's the definition of sanity.
Yeah. I just thought of this question I'd throw it at you. As a 20-year-old, because when I was a 20-year-old, I didn't really understand any of this stuff. Okay, but as a 20-year-old who has now, from being a Bitcoiner and going down the rabbit hole, an understanding of money and an understanding of how the world is trending towards more control and less freedom, towards central bank digital money, which is, as Simon Dixon always perfectly puts it, a money you can't own, a money you can't spend permissiously, and a money that doesn't have a fixed supply, and Bitcoin being the total opposite of that, you know, are you fearful about the future, knowing that you're going to be pushed into these monies, or are you more hopeful because you understand Bitcoin is the opposing force to all this?
I'm hopeful because I'm fearful. If I wasn't fearful, there'd be nothing to hope for, really. I'd just be like, oh, we're already there. But I'm fearful because I think that it's a terrifying future. There's been many books, dystopian books, 1984 and A Brave New World, the two main ones, that both paint pictures of a dystopian future. 1984, which is sort of, it's dystopian by using the stick and punishment, and A Brave New World is a dystopian future that uses the carrot and reward. And both are equally as terrifying, and both are increasingly realistic opportunities, or increasingly realistic pictures of a potential future that we could see if we hand over too much sovereignty to too few people. Because those few people, well, first off, there's sort of a design choice in humans, which is that they die, and this gives humans the opportunity to be replaced, and so there's not one tyrannical leader that is alive for thousands of years and never gets changed. We swap out and we iterate as humans in order to reach whatever goal this whole Earth thing is trying to achieve. And so I think if we go down the increasingly centralized route, then we end up in a future that may look much worse than most people would predict with pessimistic eyes, because if you look at the history of humans and how they've interacted with each other and with the space that they exist in, they are always taking as much wiggle room as they possibly can. We all do this. It's not just the crazy ones at the top. Every single human does this. You will take the wiggle room that you're given. And this applies to me, it applies to you, it applies to my dog. It's just the nature of things that if you have a bit more space, you're going to take it and you're going to expand until somebody tells you to go away. And the beautiful thing about that is that it doesn't just apply to governments. They're not just going to edge and take as much space as they can. We have the same thing. We have the same choice. And so as governments are sort of edging us closer to a world that's more centralized and in which we have less autonomy, they tend to do that until they cross a line and the people go no, and they step back, and then they slowly edge forwards again, and then we go no, and they step back. But overall, they're getting closer and closer. In the same way, we can do that. And I think it starts with Bitcoin.
Yeah. Deadly. I'd try and think about, you know, as an investor, you always try and position yourself so if the worst case scenario comes true, that what's that look like and can you survive it? But like, do you ever think about a world where we're dead wrong about Bitcoin? And can you steel man like the argument about why Bitcoin is, there's nothing here?
So
it's hard.
I think I'm just trying to get it right. So if you look at World War II, that happened. That was bad, very, very bad. And there was a lot of people who were very subscribed to the axial forces, and a lot of normal people that were subscribed to that. And that occurred only 100 years ago, right? The future in which Bitcoin doesn't succeed is one that requires even less participation from less humans. In fact, it's the lack of participation that would solidify that future. And so as long as humans become distracted and apathetic towards problems bigger than themselves, we could see a future where everything goes to hell and people just don't care enough because they're tired. Maybe they're working too much, or there's other things going on and they're focused on various distractions, and they can just about breathe enough to continue on as they are, and the edging government gets closer and closer, and to, you know, with CBDCs and then they oppose this restriction and that restriction inch by inch, and eventually people have lost their freedom as they once knew it, and they haven't even realized how they got there. It's like when you boil a frog, right? The old saying that if you increase the temperature by 1 degree, it doesn't notice that it's being boiled alive eventually. I think something like that very much well could happen. And humans, as much as we are brilliant, we're also incredibly dismissive of some very important things. And if, especially if they're not directly against our face like this, like me with time when I was younger, it's easy to sort of sweep things under the rug. And I think if enough people sweep under the rug the fact that their freedoms are being eroded, then we could end up with a world that has incredibly eroded freedom. So I think it's, as much as Bitcoin is designed perfectly, humans aren't. And so it's the lack of participation from humans that I think are the biggest threat to the flourishment of Bitcoin.
Okay, yeah. And how likely do you think that is?
God, no, that's a really hard question to ask. Like, I don't know. From the looks of it, what I'd like to see, I think, going forward into the future is more interest across more people, but less magnified. Like, the interest in Bitcoin at the moment is incredibly strong amongst very few people. And if you want it to succeed, because it's a social network, essentially, money is a social network, you want it to be maybe spread a bit more thin across more people, and more people thinking, oh yeah, Bitcoin, that's cool, and I'll use it, sure, and that's it. But instead we have most people going, Bitcoin, that's weird, I'm not going to use it, and then a few people saying Bitcoin is God. And so we need a little bit more, I think, of an even spread throughout the world, just to get the actual momentum, and the network effect then can compound. So yeah, I don't know how likely it is.
Yeah, I suppose. Well, maybe that just is the organic way it spreads. It starts with crazies and filters through, and you know, yeah. Just like, I suppose people give examples to the internet, but in the early days of the internet, some people probably had it figured out at a really deep level. Like, I don't know how the internet works. I just know I click onto it and type in stuff and it takes me there, you know, and then in time, most people won't understand, I guess, how Bitcoin works. They just understand that if you have money and you want to save it somewhere, you don't need to move the money for the next few years. This is the vehicle where you put it in, and everybody else does it too. And none of us know why it works. We just know that it does work.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what I mean. That's how I'd want it to, how I'd want to see it grow over the next like decade or so, is more people just using it in general. And if they're super into it and they're obsessed with it, cool. I don't think that's a bad thing. I just think it just needs a little bit more width.
Deadly. Proof of work. Back to the physical fitness. No one can lift the weights for you. But why is it important that Bitcoin works on proof of work mining? When, you know, I suppose if you're newer to Bitcoin or trying to get your head around it, you're like, well, Ethereum uses 99% less energy than Bitcoin, so Ethereum good, Bitcoin bad. How would you explain proof of work mining and why it's critical?
So I'd say that you've got to take a look at the causal relationships between the different concepts that exist as subcomponents of Bitcoin, in a sense. So that sounded weird, but what I mean is you have to look at where each thing comes from. People think that there's Bitcoin, which is the entirety, and then within Bitcoin there is, you know, the consensus mechanism, and there's blockchain, and then there's the UTXOs, and then there's the protocol, and then there's the community and whatever you want to put into that umbrella. But what you've got to, I think, look at it as is like, okay, what creates what out of all the subcomponents of Bitcoin? What creates what? Well, at the very bottom level, you've got computers, right? Computers create the software, and the software, then being the protocol, actually creates the consensus mechanism. And the consensus mechanism is this proof of work thing that you're talking about. I think that's where the entry point is. That's what's first, because that was the actual solution to the digital money problem. It wasn't the blockchain. The blockchain is actually a product of the consensus mechanism, not the other way around. And I think that's a big misconception that a lot of people have, is they think that the blockchain is just like the technology and the consensus mechanism tags on. but it's very much the other way around. You have the consensus mechanism, of which the blockchain is a subcomponent, and it's created from the it's created by necessity by the actual consensus mechanism of not just proof of work, which is one element, but the entirety of the protocol around consensus, which is, I think, the core value proposition of Bitcoin. And so with Bitcoin,
could you maybe just explain the consensus mechanism, and then we can see that how the blockchain comes second, just in case people aren't up to speed on that.
Yeah, so the consensus mechanism is it's sort of a combination of many different protocols and pieces of software that all act towards creating a state of decentralized consensus. And one of the pillars of that is proof of work, which is this system by which you tag a very complex hashing algorithm onto something, and then you use the successful solving of that problem as proof that the energy required to solve the problem was expended. Because without the solution, without expending the energy, you'd never find the solution. And so the solution to that problem acts as proof of the energy expended in order to solve it. And so by having this proof of work system, you can create a time chain or a blockchain of appendages to a digital distributed ledger that everybody can look at and independently verify that the entire chain is sound. And you don't need to actually have any authority speaking to you in order to do that, because the actual authority is being substituted by physics, which is that it does take this much energy in order to find this indescribably complicated problem solution. And so the consensus mechanism is that, as well as, you know, the role that nodes play, and there's a lot of different elements to it. But it's the cornerstone of that entire system is proof of work. And without that, it wouldn't function correctly, because people could just append whatever they want whenever they want, and there'd be no easy way to independently verify the legitimacy of additions to the chain. And so this consensus mechanism is in order to create digital money, right? And what's digital money? It's if it's good money, if it's sound money, it's finite and it's scarce. And so how do you make a finite scarce resource on a digital standard? Well, you have to tie it to a finite and scarce resource. And the most fundamentally scarce resource of all resources is energy itself. That's what makes the scarcity of energy is what makes every single other resource scarce. Because if you had an abundance of energy, if you could copy and paste energy, for instance, then you'd have enough energy to go and find as much gold as you wanted and then rebuild everything and alchemize gold or whatever it was, or fly to different asteroids and get it, or harvest all the energy from the sun. And so energy is the fundamentally scarce resource. And when you're creating a scarce thing on a digital standard, it needs to be bound by something scarce. And so when you have energy as the backbone of your consensus mechanism, then you have your consensus mechanism generating your chain, which is the blockchain, the history of ledgers. And then Bitcoin itself is sort of a emergent property of a properly functioning blockchain. So when you have a blockchain that is functioning correctly, it's mathematically sound, which just means that you can add up all of the incomings and the outgoings of every single address on the Bitcoin blockchain, and it will all come to zero, because that's exactly, you can't spend more Bitcoin than you have, which is a kind of like the whole goal of creating a finite form of digital money. If you can spend more than you have, then it's not finite. And that's what you can do with fiat. You can spend more than you have. So in order to ensure that, you have to pin it to something that is just as scarce, which is energy. And when you look at proof of stake, well, that's awkward, because as we just discussed, you have the consensus mechanism generating the chain, and then the token of the chain is an emergent property of the chain. But with proof of stake, the token of the chain, which is an emergent property of the chain, is the backbone or the input to the consensus mechanism, which generates it. So you have a circular reasoning in the design of the entire thing, which is, again, I think Vitalik said it best when he said he can invent new laws of physics. Again, that's the insanity I was talking about before we had to brush up against hard truths. Now we can sort of go a little bit crazy and play God. And that's exactly what Vitalik is doing with proof of stake.
Yeah, that's deadly. That's really interesting. I was just thinking there about, let's say in the future, if energy is free, how does that affect proof of work? Does it affect Bitcoin?
Energy can't be free, it's the fundamental cost.
Okay, so it can't be. It has a fundamental cost, right?
Long
So
as, unless you can find a way to undo the law of thermodynamics, which states that energy cannot be created nor destroyed, it will always be finite, and any use of that energy will, I mean, you could think of like some type one civilization, which is like some super advanced, maybe us, like 100 billion years into the future, where we're able to transfer every form of energy, whether it's thermal or nuclear or kinetic, and transfer it into any other form of energy we want at ease with 100% efficiency. That's a theoretical thing that probably will never happen. And so, as long as that example doesn't happen, then every use of energy will cause some energy to be irredeemably lost to the atmosphere, whether it's as a temporary spark of light or of heat. And so, energy will always be scarce and finite. And so, because of this, it can't ever be free. They might give it to you for free, but it won't be as much as you want. And when I say they, I'm talking about the government, which is essentially just another cohort of us. And so the government is never going to have some infinite source of energy. So it can you could end up getting a lot more energy. Say they come up with new energy harvesting systems. Maybe lithium fluoride thorium reactors are quite interesting because they take something that's like four times as common, more common than uranium from the Earth's core. Or was it more common than copper? I can't remember, but it's this incredibly common thing called thorium, and they can turn it into put it into a nuclear reactor that's safer than uranium ones, and turn that into an abundance of energy. I think a single handful of it is equivalent to the amount of energy that a individual human would use throughout their entire lifespan. So, but the good thing about Bitcoin is that it would adjust its difficulty to the newfound form of energy, and everything would be back to square zero. So that's why Bitcoin is so just incredible.
Yeah, okay. Deadly man, thanks for that. I see Bitcoin as like really obvious. Just from I've been an investor for 10 years and I wasn't investing in Bitcoin for 10 years, unfortunately. So I'm obviously not the smartest investor on the planet, but I've had a lot of success investing into business. That's been my main niche. Because it's I just see it as perfect scarcity and just with Dini's way of looking at the world, which is always just a really simple, simplify everything as simple as possible. It's just like most things on the planet, all money on not all money, but a lot of monetary energy is just looking for scarcity. Whether it's in bonds or the stock market or precious metals or collectibles or land or physical property, it's they're just systems of manufactured scarcity, and Bitcoin is an order of magnitude better because it's a digital version and it's more so a perfect scarcity, and it's got so much advantages that the physical forms of scarcity don't have. Do you see it like that? Do you see, like, I see Bitcoin eventually sucking in capital from all these asset classes. Do you see the world like that, or how do you see it? Do you see it as obvious as that, or am I missing something?
Yeah, I think so the way I see it is money is a product, and because we exist on a free market system, not just in terms of our politics, just that is how the universe or planet Earth works. It's the best product that serves its purpose will be most widely adopted. And I think Bitcoin, the nature of Bitcoin is money. It is a money, and money is a measurement tool for value. Because it is a finite measurement, there can only be so much of it. It will have to expand and contract to measure all of the value that we ascribe to it. And so, as Bitcoin becomes more successful as money, the 21 million of them will have to expand to encapsulate or be capable of measuring bigger and bigger portions of total value. And as that happens, yeah, that's what I think of as. It's not so much that Bitcoin is sucking in all of this value. The value is still just there out in the world. But as more people decide to use Bitcoin as the measurement tool by which they account for that value, it will account for more value.
Yeah, but money is also not just the unit of account, but it's also the system for storing value. And like my argument is, well, property has been used as money, land has been used as money, it's been used to store value. The stock market has been used as a store of value. the collectible market has been used as a store of value, and I see Bitcoin as being the better store. So you would move your value from storing it in an inferior store to a better store.
Yeah. When I say more people choose to use that measurement system by which to account for the value, that's what I'm talking about. It's more people choose to store, the way you choose a money is by storing your value in it, which essentially just means putting an order book placement, which is like all of these collectibles or this house for X amount of Bitcoin, which is obviously a bid which pushes the price up, and enough of those bids, the price keeps increasing. So yeah.
Would you see it as obvious as I would?
As in it will obviously happen?
Yeah, that is just gonna suck the value out of all these other asset classes. Maybe suck the value isn't the term that you like, but do you see Bitcoin as an asset class increasing and people, let's say, if you as a 40-year-old, you're doing well, generally you buy a second property. That's just a done thing. That's been the way it's been all my life, is, you know, that's how you get ahead. And then you buy the stock market. But, yeah. I think that changes. I don't see you, and you're my age, as going down that route. I think there's going to be a different option for people.
Yeah, I think it'll probably, black swans aside, it'll become the primary store of value for everybody globally.
Deadly Man, I asked this question for a bit of fun in all my podcasts, and it's just 2030. What's the price of Bitcoin? What's the highest price it hits in 2030? We won't hold you to it.
We know 2043 earlier.
Yeah, that was the ideal world, and you did give me $1 million Bitcoin, but 2030.
So 2030, it's 2023. I know I said $1 million for 2043, but I think it could easily pass that by 2030. But if not, I'd say 740,000.
Awesome. Deadly Man, thanks. And I only found out this morning that you wrote a book, so it would be criminal of me not to ask you what it's called and where I can get a copy for myself.
It is called Do Bitcoin, The Future of Money and What You Need to Know. It's basically my attempt at making Bitcoin as understandable as possible to people that don't have a history with computers or technology or any of the lingo around finance. And so the whole idea of the book was to see if I could explain Bitcoin without mentioning Bitcoin and without mentioning blockchain, without mentioning mining, without mentioning any of the words that were sort of created as a way of explaining Bitcoin when Bitcoin emerged. I just use basic concepts that people already have about interpersonal dynamics and incentives and humans in general to figure out how I can explain how Bitcoin works and what it is without using any of the lingo. So I think it's a good book to buy for somebody that doesn't, maybe your grandma or your parents, or somebody that's not too into any of the finance money stuff and thinks that you're a bit weird. Maybe get them a copy of my book as a gift.
Awesome. Deadly. Yeah, I'll have to pick that up. Where can people follow you or connect with you? What sort of socials are you on? Where would you like to direct people?
So first off, there's the YouTube channel at Fast Bitcoins. So I make weekly videos where I try to tackle a new concept around Bitcoin or a new topic around surrounding it and make it as understandable as possible and a little bit more pretty with some stock footage and animations and stuff. And that's sort of my main project at the moment. Beyond that, I'm at Angelo_Summers, spelled SOMERS, on Twitter, and at Angelo.Romana, spelled RAMANA, on Instagram. And I think that's about it.
Deadly, yeah. Gee, I have to say your YouTube videos, the production quality is unreal. Do you do them yourself?
Yeah. Thank you.
You've got some skills, man. It's awesome stuff. Yeah. So
yeah, I appreciate
I'd encourage all the listeners to check it out. There's some great content there, really educational stuff. Well, Angelo, thanks for today, man. It's been awesome to chat to you, get some time, get some education, and meet you here. It's been awesome. Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's been good talk. Thanks for having me.